طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinians' struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is produced by Despina Moutsouris. This is your host, John Roberts. A few weeks ago, This Week in Palestine was contacted by Mark Picard, a radio producer from Prague, Czech Republic, who has been airing our broadcast on a Czech program called Radio Free Radical. Mark informed us that Miko Peled was coming to speak in Prague, and did we want him to record the speech for This Week in Palestine? Yes, was the immediate answer. And so this morning we feature Miko Peled from Prague in a speech he gave shortly before the recent Israeli election. Miko Peled is an Israeli citizen born into a prominent Israeli military family who has become a sharp critic of the Israeli occupation and a staunch advocate for the rights of Palestinians. The broadcast stretches the limits of our time, so we will go right to it.
I got here after being in Washington, D.C. now for 3 days during the Netanyahu, as you may have heard, Netanyahu decided to have a campaign stop in Washington, D.C. on his way to the Israeli elections. The Israeli elections are coming up in less than 2 weeks, I think. And Washington, D.C. was an important campaign stop for him. And what was amazing to see was just the love and the support that he received in Washington, D.C. He managed to get hours and hours and hours on CNN and all the other networks full of praise. And his face was on the front page of every major newspaper day after day after day. At first discussing whether he will give the speech, whether he will not give the speech, who will attend the speech, who will not attend the speech. Will President Obama do this in regards to Netanyahu, or will President Obama do something else in regards to the great Netanyahu? And then until the last moment, we didn't know who will show up and who won't show up. Turns out the vast majority, of course, of the spineless and, you know, shameless members of Congress did show up. And it went on and on and on. And, of course, he walked in to a standing ovation and received who knows how many standing ovations at the United States House of Representatives. And then the following days, there was still more talk, and his picture was on the front page some more. And, you know, he didn't have to pay for all this. This was all free campaigning, free advertising. And it's amazing to see just how effective the Israeli lobby really is. This was probably the most powerful example of how effective the Israeli lobby is in the United States. There is no other head of state, I think, including the President of the United States, who can get such a reception, who can manage to put something like this together. And of course, he made the President of the United States look small and unimportant, because everybody knew that the President opposed this speech. The members of Congress who did show some backbone and some conscience and did not attend looked like a bunch of foolish children. Nobody took them seriously. You couldn't even tell that some of the seats were empty, because I think they filled them with volunteers. And then John Kerry, who was trying to negotiate some kind of a deal with the Iranian government, looked like some fool who was standing around with, you know, bearded men from some faraway country. This is the impression there was in the United States, and it was all about Netanyahu. And now he's returning to Jerusalem. he doesn't really need to campaign. He's coming back like, you know, Caesar coming back to Rome after some big conquest. And all the other politicians who are running against him look like children again. This was really unbelievable. It's really unbelievable, and I say this, you know, kind of a joking way, obviously, but it's tragic. Probably the biggest success of this whole Netanyahu festival in Washington, D.C., is the fact that Palestine was not mentioned even once. The Palestinians were not mentioned even once. The fact that Netanyahu was responsible for the cold-blooded murder of over 2,000 Palestinians in Gaza just a few months ago was not even brought up. He came out of that massacre, you know, white as snow, completely pure, completely clean. And that is probably the most troubling for people like us who care about this issue, and the most important accomplishments, that he could come out of something so horrifying and yet be shown as, once again, as this wonderful, important, intelligent, strong leader. But that's how strong that's the reality in the United States, and that's how strong the Israeli lobby in the United States is. So I thought, since, you know, the attack on Gaza, the latest massacre in Gaza was this last summer, which for many people is like a lifetime ago, and people tend to forget, I thought I'd start my comments today with Gaza and talk a little bit about Gaza. And some of you may know this, some of you may not, but I thought I'd put some stats on the screen. Now, the Gaza Strip is not an area that is somehow delineated naturally. It was delineated by, created by Israel as a place in which to home the thousands and thousands of refugees who were the victims of the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948. So they created this strip around the city of Gaza. It's about 140 square miles, which is a little bit less than kilometers. Population is about 1.7 million now. Over a million of them are refugees and their descendants from 1948. The average age is under 18, so the majority are children. The average age is actually under 17. Almost a million children live there. Very high unemployment rates, very high rates of poverty. The United Nations considers 80% to be food insecure, which means they don't know where their next meal will come from. So it's not called hunger yet, it's called food insecurity. Over 90% of the water in the Gaza Strip is unsafe to drink. And of course, Israel has this policy, and has for a very long time, of separation, which denies access to the outside world, which means people can't go to school, they can't market their products, they can't really do business, they can't travel, can't maintain any kind of normal ties with the outside world. What is fascinating, I think, about these stats is that the literacy rate in Gaza is one of the highest in the world. It's a 92% literacy rate, which is one of the highest literacy rates in the world. I think it's higher than the United States. And so you have to wonder, when you have such high literacy rates, why do you have such unemployment? Why do you have such poverty? That doesn't make sense. On top of that, when you see that over 90% of the water is unsafe to drink, we know that there's serious food shortages. We know that so many people are homeless. There's a shortage of medicine. And you think, but this is only a 10-minute drive from cities inside of Israel where there's no shortage of anything. How does that make sense? It's about a 30-minute drive from Jerusalem, and that's far. A lot of Israeli cities around the Gaza Strip, you know, where everything is perfectly fine. People live like this. So what is it that is causing this? You know, it's the brutality of the Israeli occupation. It's the cruelty of the siege that's been imposed on Gaza now for many, many years. And it's this inhumane and ongoing barrage of attacks and massacres that Israel has been imposing on Gaza, not from recently, but as far back as the 1950s. when Israel established the Gaza Strip in order to house these refugees, pretty much immediately Israel began attacking these refugees. And this image of these refugees being, you know, bloodthirsty, vicious Arabs wanting to kill Jews is exactly the image that was created at that time. And since they are bloodthirsty killers wanting to kill Jews and take revenge and so forth, we have to attack them on a regular basis. This was the rationale, and it goes on to this day. Now, of course, in the 1950s, the weapons were not as sophisticated as they are today, so the casualty rate was much smaller. They would murder 40, 50, 100, 150. In the last massacre, as we all know, they managed, I think, to kill, and they were very proud of the fact that they were able to kill something like, I don't know, 300 or 400 people in the first 5 minutes. This was claimed as a source of pride. This was claimed with pride by the Israeli forces. We also know that there's never been a military force in Gaza. There's never been a military, a tank or an F-16 or anything like that in Gaza. Yet, the state of Israel and the Israeli PR machine around the world has been able to create this image that there is some kind of horrific devil in Gaza, and that's why we have to keep attacking and killing them. So in the beginning, they used to call them, in the 50s, they called them infiltrators, which nobody really knows what that means, but we know now, I mean, we know what it means, but it's hard to kind of put your finger on it. Why is it dangerous? These were Palestinians, refugees, who would try to go back to their homes. Then they were called the Fedayeen. What are Fedayeen exactly? Again, it's some kind of mysterious kind of a killer. Who knows? Then they were called plain terrorists. Today they're called Hamas. The name changes. The quality of and the effectiveness of the Israeli weapons change. But it's really the exact same thing. And since a rational look at what exists in Gaza clearly demonstrates that there is no threat from Gaza to Israel. There's never been a threat from Gaza to Israel. We have to ask, so why? What are all these attacks about? Why is this obsession that Israel has with killing people in Gaza? And I believe the answer is that the reality in the Gaza Strip, as is the reality in other parts of Palestine, but particularly the Gaza Strip, is a threat to the legitimacy of the state of Israel. And that legitimacy is what Israel is trying to protect. That is the single most important thing, is maintaining the legitimacy, because, as I believe Israelis know too, deep down inside, although they won't admit it, the state of Israel is an illegitimate creation that was born of racism and colonialism that were imported from Europe to Palestine. So the legitimacy is at stake. Because when we look at the Gaza Strip, we'll see what the creation of the state of Israel, the price that had to be paid by the Palestinian in order to create this Zionist state, this so-called Jewish state. And therefore, they're being attacked. The legitimacy, the narrative of the heroes and so forth are what's at stake. And therefore, Palestinians have to pay the price. Because beyond that, there really is no threat. There never has been a military threat. And if we take a look at the forces that Israel uses, I was there this last summer during the attack on Gaza, and it's you hear the numbers, how many troops, tens of thousands of troops, how many planes were used, how many attacks and so forth from the air, how many millions of tons of bombs were dropped. And we see the numbers, you forget, but then you see fields, huge fields with rows and rows of tanks. And when you see them live, you have to wonder, what are they going to fight in Gaza exactly with all these forces? When you drop millions of tons of bombs on an area which is heavily populated, what do you expect to do exactly other than murder civilians? And then after that, you bring in countless tanks, who knows how many tanks, and thousands of ground forces. Are they expecting to find Rommel there again, fighting with a German? What exactly are they expecting? But this is the reality, this is what takes place. Now, it took place this last summer, it took place before that, 2009, takes place every so often. On a regular basis. You look at these forces and you have to scratch your head with disbelief. And considering life inside of Israel is not interrupted practically at all by you know, at that time, it's even more puzzling. And then, of course, this is what you see as a result. 10 minutes away from Israeli cities where life goes on completely uninterrupted. Israeli cities where you wouldn't dream of not having as much water as you need and plenty and clean, as much food or medicine or electricity. Even 10 minutes away from Gaza. Never mind, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, which are 30, 45 minute drive. I'm talking about a drive. Not even a flight. I'm talking about several kilometers. This is what these forces managed to create. Now, in the discussion, in the PR segment of the attacks, in other words, the explanation, the excuses that Israel gave to justify what they did, of course, they created this impression that, for no reason, out of the blue, rockets are flying out of Gaza. Hamas is this devil. And they're shooting at our civilians, and so we have no choice. And one of the biggest accomplishments of the Israeli public relations machine is to take everything and is to isolate every issue, so nothing is ever in context. Suddenly rockets are coming out of Gaza. Suddenly this thing called Hamas, this monstrous creation that we don't know why they came or where they're from, but we know they're evil. Although we know exactly when Hamas was established and why, as a resistance organization, which never would have been created had there not been an occupation and had there not been Israeli oppression. As we know, resistance organizations are created in response to oppression, which is exactly what Hamas is. But there's no context to any of it. So what I'm going to try today to do is bring it back into context a little bit by talking about the very beginning. The context of the reality in Gaza is the partition, the occupation, and the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, which began with the partition plan of 1947, November 1947, and then what happened immediately after that. So we had the partition, then we had the occupation, and the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. If we don't discuss that, then there's no way to discuss what happens in Gaza or any other part of Palestine. If we don't discuss that, then we can't discuss the issue of the refugees. Nothing makes sense if we isolate it, which is why they isolate all the issues. The only way to make sense of the thing of Palestine and the question of Palestine is to bring everything back into the context, and this is the context. And again, this was all done at a time when Europeans felt quite comfortable taking other people's land and dividing it among themselves, and that's really what the partition plan is. It's taking Palestine, which belongs to the Palestinians, dividing it, and giving the larger portion to a very small community of Jews who had, this very small, would almost literally come off the boat. In other words, this was the Jewish community in Palestine in 1947 were my grandparents' generation who immigrated, who came to colonize Palestine, and my parents' generation who were born there, about 500,000 people, that's it. Yet somehow the partition plan, and you can see clearly on this map, the larger portion of the country was given to the smaller Jewish community. And this absurd idea that somehow the Arabs should have accepted it, the Arabs, the Palestinians, or, should have accepted this, and that they made a mistake that they didn't accept this, has nothing, it's completely absurd. And then, immediately after that, the Zionist forces began occupying, began destroying Palestinian, or I should say conquering, and in the process destroying Palestinian towns and villages and executing the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And by the end of 1948, pretty much, it was done. Palestine was almost completely occupied. Hundreds and hundreds of towns and cities were destroyed, and almost 1 million Palestinians were forced into exile. Without that, there would not be a Gaza Strip. There would be no need for a Gaza Strip. There would be no refugee problem. There would be no occupation of Palestine. And that is the context, and this is exactly why the narrative that the State of Israel and the Zionist movement created, that begins right at this time as well, is completely, completely the opposite of what actually took place. It's a narrative of heroism. It's a narrative of defense. It's a narrative of a small nation regaining its independence and its historic homeland and all this stuff that sounds almost biblical. It's so romantic and heroic, and it's complete nonsense. None of it is true. There was no heroism here. It was planned as an act of terrorism, executed as an act of terrorism, and planned and executed as an act of ethnic cleansing. But that narrative is the other part of what the Zionists or in the state of Israel hold on to and will defend at every cost. Because without that narrative, there is no legitimacy. Without that narrative, nobody can justify or support the state of Israel. So they throw in the Holocaust, they throw in anti-Semitism, they put it all in one big pot, mix it up, and they've got this wonderful narrative again, which sounds like it came out of the Old Testament. It's so heroic. The Arabs attacked, we defended ourselves, and so on and so forth. Another part of the Zionist narrative has to do with the fact that there actually was no Palestine. And whatever little there was of Palestine was insignificant and backwards and dirty and primitive and uneducated. Basically, nomads and a few poor farmers. So I always like to show these pictures of the city of Yaffa. And I know we have at least one person here from the city of Yaffa. What it was like before 1948. And this is, for example, one city, one of the cities of Palestine before 1948. It was a city, you know, a large Arab city on the coast of the Mediterranean, with some 120,000 people, with a rich political life, a rich business life, trade unions and teachers' unions and newspapers and so forth, a famous Jamal Basha theater where famous performers would come from all over the Middle East and so forth, beautiful boulevard. The Jerusalem Boulevard is still there. And this very, very large and thriving metropolis was destroyed in 1948 in a matter of 2 weeks. And a population of about 120,000 were reduced to about 3,000, all in one neighborhood with barbed wires and Israeli guards surrounding them. And many of them ended up either dead or in refugee camps. And of course, on the very ruins of the city of Yaffa, we have the city of Tel Aviv, an Israeli city. And there still is a community. Tel Aviv calls itself Tel Aviv Yaffa. And there still is a community, a Palestinian community in Yaffa, but it's very small, it's neglected, it's deprived, it's oppressed, it's harassed by the Israeli security forces and so forth, even though they're Israeli citizens. And beyond the history lesson, there's something that's very important to make note of, and that is that Yaffa is part of Palestine. Palestine is not the West Bank. Yaffa is part of Palestine, just as Haifa is, and Acre, and all these other cities, Bezaba, all the other cities in Palestine where Palestinians still live. Israel likes to refer to them as the Arabs of Israel, but these are Palestinians who live under a completely different reality, even though they're Israeli citizens, a completely different set of laws, and a completely different reality from Israeli Jews. And the problems the Palestinians face are not limited to the West Bank and Gaza. Palestinians face the problems of the issues of oppression and neglect and racism and terrorism in all parts of Palestine. So when we talk about Palestine or free Palestine or solution to Palestine, we have to remember the West Bank and Gaza are only two small parts of Palestine. And we cannot forget and we cannot neglect places like Yaffa and some of the other places. Now, you're never going to see Israeli children looking like this or living like this. You're only going to see in that area Palestinian children. Now, some refugee camps look worse, some refugee camps look a little bit better, but basically, this is what life looks like in Palestinian refugee camps. Now, if this was a picture taken in some remote outpost in Afghanistan where there is no electricity and there is no water and there is no development, it would still be tragic and wrong, but somehow perhaps understandable. When children live like this, 10 minutes away from completely modern, developed Israeli towns, where you wouldn't dream of seeing sewage in the streets, or children without proper nutrition and health care, without access to proper heating and water supply, then you have to wonder what is going on here. And when only Palestinian children look like this, not Israeli children. And I think what's important to come to terms with is, number one, this reality exists only because Israel maintains it. Palestinians in refugee camps live like this only because Israel keeps them there, for no other reason. And every dollar that goes to support Israel, every gun that is sold to Israel, every comment that is made by an American or a Western leader that supports the state of Israel, keeps these children like this. Because Israel is the reason Palestinian children, millions of them, live in these horrible conditions, again, sometimes only minutes away from the very towns and cities from which their parents and grandparents were exiled. This is happening right now, under our watch, while we are sitting here. While Czech politicians and British politicians and German politicians and American politicians bow down to Netanyahu and just can't wait to collaborate with Netanyahu and can't wait to sell him weapons and give him money and invite him and God knows what else. And in a very clear way, we are all complicit with this reality. It's unjustifiable by any means. It's inexcusable by any means. And this is the reality without the massacres. This is the reality without F-16s dropping millions of tons of bombs on these people. This is the reality when things are calm, when things are good. Now, this is what the map of occupied Palestine between 1949 and 1967, pretty much. And it's interesting when we hear people talk, because people talk about the occupation of Palestine beginning in 1967. People talk about the occupied Palestinian territories as the territories that were taken by Israel in 1967, meaning the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. But that is as untrue as it could possibly be. That is as misleading as it could possibly be. The occupation of Palestine began in 1948, and the majority of Palestine was occupied in 1948. Two areas that Israel chose not to occupy in 1948 and were delineated by Israel and created by Israel are the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And in 1967, Israel decided to take them as well. It didn't begin the occupation in 1967. It completed the occupation of Palestine in 1967. The occupation of Palestine is something that's been going on for almost seven decades. The last part of the occupation, the last part of the conquest, was the conquest of the West Bank and Gaza in 1967. And again, if we talk about a solution, then we have to talk about a solution of all of Palestine. We cannot talk about a solution in two small areas of Palestine. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. Now, it's interesting because we hear, and well, this is in fact what happened in 1967. Palestine was crossed off the map completely. Israel completed the occupation and established a single state with exclusive rights for Jewish people on all of Palestine. Calling it a Jewish state. What is Jewish about the state of Israel? I really don't know. The majority of the people who live there are not Jewish. Out of 12 million people, 6.1 million are Palestinians. Out of 12 million. So the majority of people who live there under Israeli rule are not Jews. And of course, Israel rules the entire country. The majority of Jews in the world don't live there. They live in other places. What is Jewish about it? I don't know that they espouse any particular Jewish values. Certainly, dropping millions of tons of bombs on innocent civilians is not Jewish values. Another mistake that people make is they talk about the apartheid regime as though it exists only in the West Bank and Gaza. The apartheid regime in Palestine was established as soon as the state of Israel was established. Laws that keep the Palestinians out of the life of the economic life of the state, out of the social life of the state, out of every aspect of the state of Israel were put in place immediately when the state of Israel was established, and creating a clearly defined apartheid state immediately. The majority of the land is not available for Palestinians to purchase or lease or use. Over 90% of the country is considered as belonging to the Jewish people and therefore cannot be sold or leased to non-Jews. They're not talking about Czech people, they're talking about Palestinians who they're trying to keep away. Palestinians are allocated about 3% of the total water supply, even though they make up the majority of the population. Citizenship laws travel laws, marriage laws. The list goes on and on and on. Laws that pertain to property that you own or don't, or disown or used to own and so forth. Compensation for land. The ability to travel and come back. All of these laws were put in place, these are laws that affect Palestinians. All of these laws were put in place in order to discriminate against the Palestinian population as soon as the State of Israel was established in 1948. Palestinians who became eventually the citizens of the State of Israel live under a different set of laws than I live in when I'm there, or when I grew up there. Completely different set of laws besides the neglect and besides the reality in which they live, which is a reality of neglect by the state and horrifying racism. Then when the West Bank was taken, military law was imposed and is still in place. So Palestinians, depending on where they live under different sets of laws, but they are entirely different than the laws under which Israelis live. And that's regardless if they're in the West Bank, as many Israelis do live in the West Bank, or what used to be the West Bank, or they live in other parts of the country. So the occupation and the apartheid both go back to 1948. They didn't start in 1967. And when Israel did take the West Bank, immediately they began an ethnic cleansing, destruction of cities and towns, and building for Israeli Jews only, just like they did in other parts of Palestine. So in terms of Israeli thinking, there is no difference between different parts of the country. It's all the land of Israel. It's all the state of Israel. This is a picture of the Israeli army's top command immediately after the 1967 war. Standing in the center is the president of the state of Israel. Israel has kind of a symbolic president. And there is a myth that says, that has been accepted as reality, that claims that Israel was somehow under attack. There was somehow an existential threat to the state of Israel just prior to the 1967 war, which is why Israel began the 1967 war. This myth was created and perpetuated by these men who knew very well there was no threat. And the reason I know that they knew, number one, because my father was one of them, and he said that. He's one of the few that actually admitted there was no threat, that it was a war of choice. And when I was working on the book, I was able to go into the Israeli Army archives and read the minutes of the meetings of these generals just prior to the war. The only debate was how to seize the opportunity to defeat the Arab armies, because they knew full well the Arab armies were weak and unable to fight, and were no threat and no challenge to the Israeli forces. And when it was done, these generals, and even field officers of lower rank, admitted the point of the 1967 war was to finish the job. The taking of the West Bank was finishing the job, finishing the occupation of Palestine. Even they referred to it as finishing the job, finishing the occupation. Not beginning an occupation. It was not the beginning of an occupation, it was the completion of an occupation. And these are the very words that they used, that the Israeli commanders used. Completing the job of 1948, which was the taking of the West Bank and, well, the entire land of Israel. Now this is a picture of my father, alone, still in uniform. And what he did, and several other Israelis eventually joined in, was very interesting. As soon as the war was over, he said, well, now we have an opportunity to solve the Palestinian problem. And the way we can solve this problem is by allowing the Palestinians some independence, or to establish an independent state on a small portion of Palestine. Understanding full well that maintaining this occupation over a large population, which was included in the taking of the West Bank, would harm the state of Israel. So in order to maintain what was accomplished in 1948, what he and the others recommended was that we sacrifice the conquest of 1967. Allow the Palestinians a small state in an area that was determined by Israel, dealing with leaders that were determined by Israel as well, pretty much, in order to maintain the conquest of Palestine of 1948, which was the majority of the land. And this is what the two-state solution is about. And this is when the idea of the two-state solution under these terms, in other words, the West Bank and Gaza, began. And immediately when he said this, people thought he lost his mind. Because why? How can we possibly give up a part of the land of Israel that we just conquered? We conquered it to keep it. Israel didn't build settlements, you know, they call it settlements, cities and towns in the West Bank by accident. He took the West Bank and built it for Jews only. And still he and several others tried. There was a movement within the Palestine Liberation Organization that thought this might be an opportunity, so there was this discussion between members of the PLO and my father and some other Israelis about this idea of the two-state solution based on this, and the idea was to try to convince the Palestinians that they can have peace with Israel, that they can have a peace of Palestine as their own, and perhaps this is really the only solution, or the best solution. In this picture, my father was Ehsan Sultawi, who was among the leadership of the PLO, and he was one of the main proponents of this idea that the PLO should accept the state of Israel and then negotiate a peace deal based on a two-state solution. What we do know today, however, is that it was a big mistake. It proved to be disastrous. We know today that the fact that the PLO leadership accepted and recognized the state of Israel and agreed to negotiate with the state of Israel was disastrous to the Palestinians. This is the signing of Oslo. And if nothing else, the fact that they are flanked by Mubarak and King Hussein will tell you something. Two men who were bribed in order to make peace with Israel. Two men who are at the head of non-democratic states, two dictators, who were bribed in order to make peace with Israel, which is why they made peace with Israel. Had these two countries had representative governments, I doubt very much any one of them would have signed a peace agreement with the state of Israel. But being that they are dictators and bribable, this was accomplished. And they were the ones who were kind of, you know, supporting, giving their support, their, so to speak, moral or immoral support to this idea that the Palestinians should be bribed as well and give in to Israel. And people talk today about the failure of Oslo. Oslo having been really the result of persuading the PLO and particularly Arafat to accept the state of Israel and accept the two-state solution. And people say it failed. But when we look at Oslo, we can see that Oslo did not fail. The Oslo agreements were a huge success. They accomplished exactly what they set out to accomplish, which is to destroy the Palestinians even more, to strengthen the occupation of Palestine by Israel, to make life for Palestinians worse, and to completely destroy any chance there ever was of establishing a Palestinian state. All of these things were accomplished. And it's exactly what the Oslo agreements were set to do, and they accomplished it. The life of Palestinians today is far worse than it was. The strength of the Israeli occupation is far stronger. Israel has more control of the land, the resources, and the people. All over Palestine. So these attempts by Israelis like my father, who thought that, I think they sincerely thought that a two-state solution based on those, under those conditions, was the best that that we could be expected. But it was disastrous for the Palestinians, as expected, because the Zionist state has an insatiable appetite. And once, as we know here in Prague, once you create a monster, once you create a golem, then the golem ends up destroying you. There's no way to rein it in. There's no way to rein apartheid. There's no way to rein racism. There's no way to rein in colonialism. You either oppose it completely or you accept it completely. And by accepting the state of Israel and by accepting Zionism, we have to accept the reality that exists in Palestine today. There's no way to convince or to create or for a reality where the Zionist state pulls back and says, fine, we will maintain this racist, colonialist, apartheid regime on these borders, but beyond these borders, we will allow the Palestinians freedom. That's science fiction. That's not something that you can even imagine happening. I mean, you can imagine happening, but there's no way it's going to happen. And that's what Oslo tried to do, and of course, it was a massive failure, as we know, and a complete catastrophe for the Palestinians. You know, people talk about the Palestinian catastrophe of 1948 as though it began in as though it happened in 1948. We know today it didn't happen in 1948. It began in 1948. The Palestinian catastrophe continues to this day. And the Oslo Accords were a big step in the wrong direction. I think it's important to discuss the issue of Palestinian prisoners. It's something that we hear too little about, or very little, or hardly anything about. And I think it needs to be discussed. Israel holds thousands of political prisoners, Palestinian prisoners, in violation of international law. But besides the fact that it's in violation of international law, according to Israeli sources, the vast majority of Palestinians in Israeli jails have never been charged with acts of violence. And this is by the Israeli military courts, where the bar is set very low, making them political prisoners. And then you have hundreds and hundreds of Palestinian prisoners who have never been charged with anything at all. Some of you may recall Samer Esawi, who was in this picture with his sister Shireen. Samer holds the world record for the longest hunger strike. I think he was 250 days or something absurd. And, you know, thankfully he survived. He was eventually released, gone back to jail. And all of this because of the what they call the administrative detention, the Palestinians who are held without charge for years. So the hunger strike was in opposition to that. And his sister Shireen, she's an attorney, she goes in and out of jail as well all the time. It's a huge issue. It's a huge problem. It's an integral part of Palestinian life. Now, of course, Israel calls them terrorists, but we know that the world recognizes the rights of people to resist. Now, the majority have never been charged with violence, so they're not terrorists anyway. But the right to resist is a right that the world recognizes. The United Nations even recognizes the right of people under oppressive regimes to resist. If Israel does not like rockets coming out of Gaza, then Israel has the ability to end the occupation of Gaza and let the people be free. Yet this problem is something that goes on. More and more people are being detained, and the young and the age of the prisoners gets lower and lower. We know now there's a serious problem of children as young as 10, 12, 8 being arrested by Israeli soldiers, tortured, beaten by the Israeli soldiers on a regular basis. And again, this goes on without anybody saying anything, without anybody caring, without anybody mentioning it, hailing Israel as though it was some democracy, peace-loving democracy. And again, whether it's here in the Czech Republic, whether it's in Germany, whether it's in France or Britain, not to mention the United States, people talk about Israel, people talk about Netanyahu, as though it is some fictional reality, some fictional state. Israel is a democracy? To whom? To Israeli Jews, perhaps. It is a brutal racist regime that has to be stopped. Not a democracy that has to be supported. I think that if somebody tried to describe the life of a Palestinian, a day in the life of a Palestinian, nobody would believe them. Nobody would believe them because it's so horrifying. It's beyond belief if you try to live the life of a daily life of a day in the life of a Palestinian. Nobody would believe it. It is so horrible. It's beyond belief, especially because Israel has this image of being this wonderful democracy. At the same time, I think it would be wrong to talk about this issue without discussing how we resolve it. Now, somebody asked me earlier if I was optimistic. If I wasn't optimistic, I wouldn't be doing this. There's no point in talking about Palestine, about an issue that's hopeless. But we have to get a grasp of what is happening in Palestine. We have to have a good grasp of how it happened before we can talk about a solution. This is why I like to go back into the history and put everything back in context. Without context, there cannot be a solution. So where can we find hope in Palestine? Like I said, it is a brutally racist regime. With no mercy. Palestinians are treated with no regard to their lives, with no regard to their property, with no regard to their rights by Israel. This is a reality that exists today, and we have to understand that. The reality that exists today also is that there is a single state over all of Palestine, being every life of every person in Palestine is governed by the state of Israel, albeit by different laws depending on who they are and where they live, with exclusive rights for Jews. Jews have exclusive rights. Whether you live in the West Bank, whether you live in Jerusalem, or you live somewhere else, if you're an Israeli Jew, you have exclusive rights. And that is the reality that exists today. The only way to maintain this level of exclusive rights for Jews in Palestine, is by maintaining an apartheid regime that excludes Palestinians from the life of the state. That means depriving Palestinians of water, depriving Palestinians of rights, depriving Palestinians of life, depriving them of land, depriving them of development, depriving them of being part of the political system. It means maintaining thousands of prisoners, political prisoners, in jails, because there's going to be a resistance. And it means bombing Gaza on a regular basis to kill civilians. That's the price of maintaining a single state with exclusive rights for Jewish people in Palestine, which is called the State of Israel. That is the price. It's a package deal. But we've seen regimes change and become democratic. We've seen them in Europe, we've seen them in South Africa, we've seen them in other places. And the way to move forward is to rid Palestine of the Zionist regime, to rid Palestine of what is called the State of Israel, to rid Palestine of the brutality by the same means that apartheid, that South Africa was relieved of apartheid regime. Through boycotts, through divestment, through sanctions, through isolation, through protests. There are people here from ISM, the International Solidarity Movement, they do fantastic work. These guys are real heroes. There are student groups on campuses, so on and so forth. That is the means to the end. The same means that were used to end apartheid in South Africa need to be applied in Palestine in order to free Palestine from the Zionist regime, which is really just a different name for the apartheid regime in Palestine. That has to be the focal point of all activism in regards to Palestine. Any activists that still waver about this issue need to take a moment and rethink and either get out of the way or get on board. Talking about a two-state solution is code for accepting the Israeli regime in all of Palestine. Because that is what is allowing, one of the things that's allowing Israel to continue is this notion that we do want peace and we are willing to have a two-state solution, but of course the Palestinians are the problem and we're just waiting for a different leader or a different reality or a different something. Although Israeli leaders now don't even say that. They clearly state they have no intention of ever making peace with the Palestinians. That has to be the focal point of all activism in regards to Palestine. There has to be a complete acceptance of boycott, divestment, sanctions, and isolation. Israeli ambassadors need to be sent home. Ambassadors in their sense of Tel Aviv should be brought back home. And Israel needs to be treated like the pariah state that it is. Until such time as all prisoners are freed, the siege of Gaza is released, and elections with one person, one vote are established, are scheduled. This has to be the name of the game. Nothing short of that can resolve this issue. The only way we can envision a peace is without the State of Israel. Peace between Israelis and Palestinians, of course, yes, between people, as two nations living in a single democracy. We see that all over the world. It's nothing new to have multinational states. Israelis and Palestinians can live in peace in a state that is not the State of Israel. In a state that's a democratic state that represents all the people who live in it. That is the vision that we need to espouse. That is the goal that we need to talk about. That is the focal point that has to be of all activism. Quite often you hear activists saying, well, we don't get involved, one state, two states. You're not getting involved in anything. The single state is a reality. The two-state is off the table. It's been off the table from the very beginning, actually. The question is it going to be a single state with a racist regime, or is it going to be a single state that is a democratic regime? If we care about the right of return, if we care about the refugees, and compensation and restitution for the refugees, if we care about the prisoners, if we care about seeing a peaceful solution, the key point is establishing a single democracy, because that is the first step to establishing all these other issues. The state of Israel will never negotiate. The state of Israel will never allow any of these things to happen. The state of Israel will never end the siege on Gaza. The state of Israel will never stop bombing Gaza. The state of Israel will never afford Palestinians equal rights. In fact, even the Palestinian parties within the Knesset cannot run on a platform that calls for the state to become a state of all of its citizens. They have to recognize that it's a Jewish state. They have to recognize that Palestinians are not equal citizens. So we can decide, we support the state of Israel, or we support human rights and peace and freedom and democracy. There is no middle way. There is no middle ground. That's the nature of racism. It creates a clear separation between people who support it and people who oppose it. That's the nature of it. So I, for one, oppose racism. I, for one, think it's wrong to draw bombs on innocent civilians. Even if the devil himself lived in Gaza, it still would not justify killing a single child. It's a question of values. Supporting Israel or not is a question of values. It has nothing to do with politics. It has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. It has nothing to do with Jews. It has nothing to do with the Holocaust. It has nothing to do with any of that. It is a question of values. Do we believe in equal rights? Do we believe in human rights? Do we think that a state has to establish sets of laws that apply to everyone and respect the rights of everyone? Or do we accept the racism and brutal violence? It's very simple. Now, nobody knows how long it's going to take. I'm confident the state of Israel is going to disintegrate. The reality that exists there today is not sustainable. The reality in Gaza is not sustainable. There are major shifts in the Palestinian communities who are Israeli citizens. They used to call themselves Israeli Arabs. Excuse me, now everybody's called, nobody says that anymore. Everybody waves the Palestinian flag whenever there's protests, there are protests everywhere and so forth. There are major shifts in the West Bank. There's a whole level of leadership of young, the leadership of the popular resistance, which continue to resist without violence and have become the subject of admiration of people around the world. Again, there's the BDS movement that we all know about, there's ISM, there are all these organizations and groups that support the Palestinian cause, but it has to be faster and it has to be stronger. And the longer we all take to get on board, the longer it's going to take. The longer people understand that it's either Israel or peace, the longer it's going to take, the more casualties. We haven't seen the last attack on Gaza yet. I guarantee we have not seen the last attacks on Gaza. And to think that Israel can continue to bomb innocent civilians, murder innocent civilians in cold blood, on prime time, we all saw it on television. And Israeli ambassadors are not sent home from Prague? The Israeli ambassadors are not sent home from Berlin and from London? Are they out of their minds? You know? How are people looking at themselves in the mirror? How are these governments looking at themselves in the mirror? How do they not kick out these Israeli ambassadors when the state of Israel is committing murder in prime time, 3-hour flight from here, or 4-hour flight from here? That has to be the sentiment. It has to be a sentiment of rage. It has to be a sentiment of anger. It has to be a sentiment where we are moving forward clearly and decisively to bring about real freedom. And when we say, like it says up here, free Palestine, we need to understand we have to talk about all of Palestine. If two cities in Palestine are free, it's not going to help anybody. A free Palestine means a free Ramallah and a free Gaza and a free Haifa and a free Atka and a free Bisaba and a free all of Palestine. And this will free Israelis as well as Palestinians. Because Israelis are living under this horrifying regime as well. They have exclusive rights, so they think they have it good, but they don't. A real democracy with equal rights, a peaceful coexistence under a democratic regime that represents all the people. That is the key, and that is the hope. And that can only come after Zionism. Thank you all very much.
That was Miko Peled, author of The General's Son, speaking from Prague, Czech Republic. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, and please join us again next week. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.